It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's a trailblazer with one of the world's great dishes. The trailblazer is Diana Kennedy, the woman who's tracked every regional nuance of Mexican food. The dish is that emblem of Mexico, the tamale. Well, the Stearns are blazing trails to Aloha, as in Oregon, for Rio's Southern-style ribs. How's that for a cultural mix? Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner talks everything about the kitchen sink. We have a piercing psychological examination of what makes California wine Californian, and we check out the newest leaf on the bag salad shelf. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, we have a woman I cannot resist, talking about one of Mexico's great dishes. Now, the dish is the tamale, which is superb party food, by the way. The woman is that obsessed authority on all things Mexican, Diana Kennedy. Her latest book is From My Mexican Kitchen, Techniques and Ingredients. Design guru Deborah Krasner has a guide for analyzing your kitchen sink. I'll bet you didn't get this in your psych course. Speaking of psych, reporter Scott Hodge is stomping grapes at Sterling Vineyards while trying to pierce the psyche of California wine. We dig into the story behind the newest bag salad, Mosh. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, that number's 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, where have you been recently?
Lynn, we've been in Oregon, and we found this great place called Rio's Ribs. Now, Rio is famous not only for his ribs, but for other talents as well. Have a listen.
Did you say you're related to Snoop Dogg?
Yeah, Snoop Doggy Dogg is my nephew. That's my brother's son. And my whole family into music. Come from a family of 27, 13 boys, 14 girls.
And you're into music yourself?
Yeah, I'm an artist myself.
All right, let's talk about barbecue, though. You said that your sauce here is pretty hot. Tell us about that.
It's hot, make the hair stand up on your head. Well, she'll be able to check it in a few minutes. I just gave her a sample. I had seen it put people to the ground. It's the hottest sauce in the universe.
Jane has a cup of this sauce. She's about to taste it.
It's going to sneak up on you.
Well, I'm just gonna touch it to my tongue because it's.
Go ahead and touch it. You know, even if. In the wintertime, if it's cold and you want to get warm, come get some of this hot sauce.
She just tried some.
Okay, my tongue is tingling. I'm not falling on my knees yet. Hold on. Oh, yes, here it comes. Whoa. This has got dynamite.
Her face is turning red.
Whoa. Oh.
She really is, like, turning redder and redder and redder.
Oh, my God.
We are in Aloha, Oregon, so we will say Aloha to Jane for good, I think, right?
It's fabulous.
Jane, you're still with us?
Yes. I survived and I flourished, and I'm seriously thinking of my next trip back to Aloha, Oregon, which just by the name of that town, doesn't that sound like the most unlikely place to find really good ribs?
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, this guy, he is one of the great pit masters in America. And even though Snoop Doggy Dogg and, you know, maybe a lot of other hip-hop stars know about him, I had never heard of Rio's Ribs until we just stumbled upon it one day.
And I think the important thing to note here is that not only is his sauce really hot, the milder versions, as well as the hot one, are really delicious. And the ribs themselves are the work of a master. When you drive by this place in Aloha, we had no idea it was there. We were just driving along, and suddenly we saw a cloud of smoke up ahead. We drove further, and there we saw the cloud of smoke coming from these gigantic big black drums that are outside the restaurant by the side of the road. And the smell, of course, of the ribs cooking is overwhelming. You walk inside and there's an entire barbecue buffet to pick from.
Does he do anything other than ribs?
Well, he does great side dishes. He does collard greens and mustard greens that are simmered with ham hocks. He does fried okra, red beans and rice, butter-sopped yams, macaroni and cheese, and really good cornbread, and also for dessert, sweet potato pie. But the ribs are the main course.
Oh, the brisket is very, very good, too. You can get chopped brisket on a – they call it a sandwich. It's so funny because you get – it's a length of – French-style bread just filled with this messy, well-sauced chopped brisket, utterly impossible to pick up and eat like a sandwich, and yet you're not given silverware, so the only way to do it is to just pick at it with your hands.
He's such a fascinating guy also because he, you know, I've never heard his music. But if it's anything like his talking, it's just lyrical. I mean, he told us that if birds tasted the hot sauce, they would fall from the trees, just, you know, chirping and lying on the ground with ecstasy.
In fact, he told us, I don't know if this is poetic license on his part, but he told us that the reason his hot sauce is unique and so hot is that there is a particular grove of trees back in Magnolia, Mississippi, which is where he and Snoop Dogg are from, that he gets the peppers from, and only peppers from those trees are used to make this hot sauce.
Well, there are microclimates, right?
And Magnolia, Mississippi might have one.
You
and if
got
he's
it.
One of 27 children, I suspect that probably is the town of Magnolia, Mississippi.
Well, I love the idea that it's Aloha, it's Oregon, and it's ribs, that great soul center.
And it's Southern ribs.
And it's Southern soul food ribs.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Aloha.
I didn't know there was that much of Snoop Doggy Dogg that could be on a family show. Well, the Stearns are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Every week you can hear them right here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're checking out the site, don't miss out on our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and what a deal. Every week you get a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique tips, and shopping information. Best of all, it does not cost a cent, but you can only get it by signing up on the website, splendidtable.org. Deborah Krasner writes food books like The Flavors of Olive Oil, She Cooks, and She Designs Kitchens. This woman is probably the most practical kitchen designer you are ever going to meet. And we like to talk to her about, well, how to make our kitchens work better. Hey, Deb, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
So what have you been working on? What's in the lab right now?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about sinks. And, you know, we all say everything but the kitchen sink all the time. But the fact is, the kitchen sink might be one of the most important decisions you make in your kitchen. And none of us know how to do it. In fact, I had to consult an expert. I consulted Dino Riccelli, who has a company called Luxury Home Products, and he makes custom copper sinks for people. I mean, to die for, custom copper sinks. But even if you can't buy one of his sinks, you can benefit from his advice on how to choose a sink. Because he's isolated four factors that none of us ever think about when we choose sinks. That is, when we choose sinks, we tend to look at materials. Do I want a stainless sink? Do I want a stone sink? Or we look at size. You know, do I want one big one? Do mm-hmm. I want three mm-hmm. little ones? Or we say, you know, well, do I want a 30-inch wide one or a 36-inch wide one? He says all of that's important, but that's not what you should be focusing on. What you should be focusing on is your physical relationship to the sink. And of course, I love this because that's my whole thing, is that kitchens should really be built for the people who use them according to their size and their habits. So he's figured out how to figure out what size sink you need. And he says that the four things you need to think about are reach, height, depth, and the kind of faucet it is. And let me explain that.
Okay.
He says that in old farmhouse kitchens, farmhouse sinks, you know, projected from the wall, and you basically could belly up to them, mm-hmm. and you could set them on the wall wherever it made sense for you in terms of your personal height. And the faucet came out of the wall above the sink, so it reached pretty far towards you. All of that is what we have to get back to, according to Dino. We need to have farmhouse front sinks give us that same benefit of belly to the sink, whereas undermounted stainless steel sinks, for instance, in a granite countertop, mm-hmm. Because of the constraints of granite as a material, you need to have a pretty fat ledge in front of that granite in order to have the cutout.
So there's a couple of inches between you and the beginning of the sink.
Exactly. And so unless your hands are abnormal, your arms are abnormally long, like unless you have a gorilla reach, by the time you get to the faucet in the back and running things under the water, you're bending, you're straining, and it's not comfortable for anyone.
Should a sink be high?
Well, now, a lot of people say a sink should be low because basically the relationship that you want to have to a sink is just kind of standing there in an easy, relaxed way and being able to bend your arms at the elbow and reach everything you need to reach. So you shouldn't have to extend your hands like sticks or lean forward.
Uh-huh. Okay. So that's the placement. What are the other factors?
Okay. Well, then, obviously, a faucet that will come as far close to you as possible is going to be a benefit. So you either want a high arching faucet, or a faucet that projects from the wall and is wall mounted, or a faucet that has a removable spray head so that you can bring it as far forward as you need to bring it. But essentially, you're trying to preserve that relationship of just kind of standing easily at the sink without any kind of strain.
Mm-hmm.
Then the depth of a sink is significant too, because again, if you're a short person, a sink that's too deep means you're going to be straining and bending and reaching to get to the bottom of it. So if you're under 5'3", basically your sink shouldn't be more than 8 or 9 inches deep. If you're a tall person, then you can have a sink that's 9, 10, 11, even 12 inches deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of, you know, what standing comfortably you can reach with your knuckles without bending and without really pulling on your arms.
What about the width of the sink? Because one of the things I know makes me nuts is sinks that are too small for the pots, too small for all the stuff that collects as you make a meal.
Absolutely. I have to tell you, I am now living with a 36-inch wide single bowl sink. I cannot understand how I ever lived without it. It is so wonderful.
Deb, you could swim in a sink that size.
I could bathe my dog in a sink that size. It's fantastic.
So we really do want large is good.
Large is good. Single is good. You know, the whole idea of a double sink is from when we hand wash dishes and we had soapy and hot on one side and hot and rinse on the other. And nobody does that anymore. So why do we still have this antiquated sink form?
Yeah, but you know what I like about my double sink? All the dirty stuff goes on one side and it's big. And then I've got the other side clear to stick the pot under it to fill it up to cook the corn or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right, right. But if you had a pot filler faucet, you wouldn't need that second sink.
Ah, okay. All right. All right. But, you know, some of us just
don't. If you like it, that's fine. I mean, the point really is what you like is what matters. And it isn't that there's, you know, the word coming down from on high telling you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
If it works for you, that's great.
Yeah, but this is great advice, though. Make sure it works in terms of just standing there in a relaxed way and you can easily reach. That's a great way to think about it. Hey, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Kitchen designer and food writer Deborah Krasner works out of her studio in Vermont. Her latest book is The Flavors of Olive Oil. Coming up, a tamale tour of Mexico with the one and only Diana Kennedy, seeking the inner truth of California wine, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, Super Target features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the Super Target nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. Diana Kennedy is a trailblazer. In the 1970s, when French food was the be-all and end-all, this woman published her seminal work on authentic Mexican cooking. It was called The Cuisines of Mexico. Now, Diana has lived in Mexico for nearly 50 years, and she continues to research, teach, and write. No one has equaled Diana Kennedy's dedication to every regional nuance of Mexican food. Her latest work is part encyclopedia, part step-by-step guide. It's called From My Mexican Kitchen, Techniques and Ingredients. Diana, it is good to have you with us again.
Oh, Lynn, thank you very much for that introduction. It's wonderful to be talking to you.
Well, I like trailblazers.
Yes.
Did you intend this book to be a real hand-holder? Because that's the sense I have from it.
Oh, yes, and I expect you could go into the supermarket with it. You know, supermarkets have a lot of the Mexican ingredients.
That's right.
Or the markets near you, and learn about the chilies. Make sure they're properly marked. I've been known to go into a supermarket and change the name of the chili. Yes.
Writing on the packages.
Absolutely.
Well, can we talk tamales?
Oh, yes, I'd love to. The first portable food in Mexico, perhaps.
Oh, really? I never thought about that. But of course, it's a husk of some kind with a paste of something and then a filling, right? And it's
Absolutely.
All wrapped up. So this seems always to me to be the time of year for tamales. Are they usually celebration food?
Well, they can be celebration, and it can be a breakfast food with a cup of atole or a gruel, a maize gruel, or it can be just everyday food. Now, it depends where you are. You know, in my first book, I wrote about the Zacahuil. That is the largest tamale of all from Tamaulipas.
Now, where is Tamaulipas?
Well, it's up in Tampico, around that area, the northeast of Mexico.
Okay.
And it's this huge, huge tamal that originally was made for special occasions, and that's a whole loin of pork with the bone and the fat, all wrapped in a chili paste, and then a very, very roughly ground masa. And then it's wrapped in banana leaves and held rigid, because it's literally about 3 or 4 foot long.
Oh my.
With palm things. Now, that's the largest. The smallest is in Nuevo León, around you know, Monterrey and all that area.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little finger tamal, and it's usually wrapped in just half a corn husk, a dried corn husk. And that's delicious too.
So what different kinds of fillings are there then?
Oh, there are so many. If you go down to Juchitán, rather than a filling, it's on top. They have a sort of, they call it a molito of pumpkin seeds, ground pumpkin seeds. And then they put dried fish or dried shrimp. And the masa has epazote and some chili in it.
Oh, my.
And that's wrapped usually in a banana leaf. It's absolutely delicious. One of my favorites of all time. And then let's hop over to the most delicate, rich tamal, which is a fresh corn, uchepo, they call it, a Tarascan word, that would be from part of Michoacán, not all of Michoacán. Now, that's the west, central west.
Okay.
And that is in the fresh corn husk. You make a paste of fresh corn, and it has to be obviously starchy corn,
right,
with butter or cream. And then
you
cook that. And you know what? You serve it with a piece of white cheese that will melt, a beautiful queso fresco, crema, a cream, not that awful Mexican cream you see in the markets, and really creme fraiche, a tomato sauce, a broiled tomato sauce. And it is utterly divine.
Oh, this sounds glorious.
Oh, yes, it's very delicate. But the trouble is, in the States, unless you get field corn or the corn they give to cattle, you won't have the right starch content.
So and we have to know a farmer to do this one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
But it's worth doing.
What
now?
Keep going.
See.
I'm loving this. Oh, yeah. We have a tamale tour of Mexico with Diana Kennedy. This is great. Keep going.
Well, in Tabasco and the Yucatecan Peninsula, and I believe in Guatemala too, they have what they call a tamale colado. You have a masa, typically it should be made without kal or lime.
Right. And so it's fresh cornmeal almost.
Well, it's a cornmeal. Right. Yes. Dried corn, and then it's cooked and left to soak. It is then ground fairly finely, and it's diluted with water and then strained. And that is cooked. So it becomes like, like a British blancmange, you know, right. A jellied sort of thing.
Right.
And then you stir in lots of wonderful brown lard, cook that until it's comes together, thickens like a roux, like a thick roux.
Right.
And then you let it cool. And a dollop of that will go inside a banana leaf. And then you have some very savory, usually pork filling with in Tabasco, it's a very rich sauce with achiote and all sorts of things.
Oh.
And you steam it. And it's divine. I mean, it's just like, it says it should just tremble. The masa should just tremble as you cut into it. So that's spectacular. Tamal.
You know, the thing that's so interesting about all of this is that each one of these sounds so sophisticated and also utterly different one from another. Diana, thank you for the brief Diana Kennedy tamale tour.
Oh, thank you, Lynn. I'm glad you asked me about it because I'm quite passionate about it.
Never would have guessed in a million years. You take care, dear.
I will. Thank you, Lynn.
Diana Kennedy has lived and researched in Mexico for 50 years. Her latest book is From My Mexican Kitchen, Techniques and Ingredients, and you can find her recipe for tamales with poblano and cheese on the website, splendidtable.org. Reporter Scott Haas is what I think of as an unrelenting truth seeker. Particularly food truths. He tramped into a Swiss cow pasture to find out why the milk is so good. To understand sushi, he went into Iron Chef Morimoto's kitchen and almost got his microphone cord cleavered. And his latest adventure dropped him amidst the grapevines in California with the people at Sterling Vineyards.
I'm walking on the top of Diamond Mountain in the heart of Napa Valley in Northern California. Around me are vineyards, and I'm here to find out what makes a wine Californian. Wines come from all over the world, and wines are said to speak of a sense of place. What is it about the wines from California that convey the essence of California? I'm standing in the heart of a Cabernet Sauvignon vineyard. And in the distance are forests. And what's different about this wine country here in California is that in contrast to Italy and France, where they've been harvesting and growing grapes for centuries, here it's relatively new, so you're still very close to nature. The grapes are beautiful. They're Cabernet Sauvignon Blanc grapes. And there's big clusters, almost a dusky purple color. I'm going to grab a few here. Oh, boy. There's a real sweetness about them. And you can even taste the beginnings of a structure in these grapes. They're just delicious. And you can see where this is going to make great wine. Cutting off these Merlot grapes and tossing them in a large bin. I've been handed a very, very sharp miniature sickle. It's got a bright orange handle, and the blade is, as I say, extraordinarily sharp. Supervising my work is Manuel Sanchez. Manuel, what do you think of my cutting technique?
Yeah, it looks pretty slow, but we can give it work for you. You had to work a little fast.
Can you show me what your technique is? I mean, just do a cut.
You bust right in the meat, like this.
Oh, I see.
So, don't look too much, you know, the other way.
So basically, you're going about 10 times faster than I'm doing it.
I see.
You
have to move your hands.
I don't even see you cutting them. It's
the other way, you don't make money, you know.
I understand. It's like you're moving like a hummingbird.
Unbelievable.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I know. Thanks a lot. Hi, could you just tell me your name, please?
Jeffrey Stambor.
What's your job here?
I am the winemaker responsible for red Bordelais varietals.
When I have a wine from California with a varietal like a Merlot or a Cabernet Franc or Cabernet Sauvignon or some combination of these grapes, it still tastes of California to me. Is that an accurate perception?
I think so. And I think it's because of the climate that we have to deal with. I think some of the early people that tried to transfer the whole entire French experience, which would include wine style, onto California, they failed until they kind of adjusted their thinking, their habits, their production to the California situation.
What's the connection between the California lifestyle and the California wine?
I don't think it's a connection between the lifestyle. I think it's the climate. I mean, it would be terroir.
I think I know what you mean, but it's a very hard word to translate or define. But
it's the sum of all the elements that go into wine from a place. So it's the soil, it's the climate, it's the culture around wine as well.
It's how the wines evoke a place.
Right.
So tell me then how California's life, culture, is then embodied in its terroir.
Well, I guess that certainly forwardness would be a trait. What do I use as well? Juicy, expressive. I mean,
there's an immediacy about the wines.
Yeah, certainly they're enjoyable at a younger date.
I'm standing in another part of the winery, and it's really high tech. It's state of the art. In contrast to, say, Diamond Mountain, which was rustic and beautiful, here I'm walking beneath eight very enormous stainless steel tanks. Over to the right, there's a huge green and yellow press, and it looks like almost a mini oil refinery, only they're not refining oil, they're refining wine. And that's also part of the story of California wines. I mean, California is a place that, if it's new, we'll try it. It's a new world. We're inside Cellar 2 at Sterling Vineyards, and to my left there are wooden barrels holding wine, and to my right is Rob Hunter. Rob, pleasure to meet you.
Glad to be here.
When you come into a cellar, what are some of the important details that you're sensing that are important for the wine to mature to its greatest potential?
I'm smelling wines as they age. I'm getting some of these evaporative wine and alcohol aromatics, but also you smell things. You can smell a barrel that's leaking. In fact, you can smell a barrel if it has fruit flies gathering on it. You can actually smell them. You're smelling for cleanliness. I want to make sure that there's not a residual cleansing agent.
You're obviously someone very passionate about wine, but I'm also getting a sense that you're kind of obsessive about it too. Do you need that to make wines? Are you an obsessive kind of guy?
Well, there is a great degree of order that goes on, and it kind of goes back to those OCD roots, but it should not be multiple randomness. Order is very important.
It's not, nothing happens by accident. Well, nothing should happen by accident.
Certainly.
Rob, what's the name of this room?
This is the Shay, and this is where we store the reserve and single vineyard wines. And here I've got a row of barrels from the Three Palms Vineyard. This is the 2002 vintage. So this wine's been in barrel now for 9 months, and we'll have another 9 months in barrel.
Well, I just spat the wine, because otherwise, if I had a lot of wine to drink, I wouldn't be able to conduct this interview very well. So it's very delicious, but it's very tight. I mean, you can see where it will need to open up a little bit, right?
The thing that we see here in this wine is the intensity of fruit.
Absolutely.
This is almost as though it's Merlot extract. Some people call it affectionately Merlot on steroids.
And what's intriguing to me about it also is that you know immediately that it's a California Merlot.
For me, when I'm tasting a Merlot from California, there's an incredible concentration of flavor and also an elegance to that fruit.
Do you think the personality of the wines from California have anything to do with the way people live here?
Oh, I don't know if I could go that far, because I'd like to say that those of us that live here are relaxed, and yet I don't think these wines are relaxed at all. I think that they're pretty high-strung. I think that they're high temper, and hopefully I'm a little bit more laid back than the wine.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for taking the time to show me around.
Absolutely. Glad to do it. Please come back.
Scott Haas lives in Boston, but he'll go anywhere for a story. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have got Pauline on the line. Pauline, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's such fun to listen to your program, and I always get a good idea at least once a week.
Thank you.
In June, my husband and I dined at a very nice restaurant in Barcelona, and we were served some very thin sliced beef. It looked like a tenderloin cut.
Yeah.
And it was cooked on a bed of what looked like rock salt, very hot rock salt. They brought you a cool platter of meat.
Yeah.
And you took a fork and put it on the rock salt, and it kind of sizzled a little bit, and then you turned it over, and the meat was less than a quarter of an inch thick, but not paper thin.
And what was the rock salt in?
It was in a pan. The bed was probably 3 inches thick in the middle, and it sloped a little bit to the side.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I've tried repeating it twice, thinking, you know, I'm assuming that this is how they do it.
Yeah.
Warmed the salt in the oven up to 500 degrees, but somehow or other I can't keep it to stay warm, even though I've put it in a cast iron pan to try to heat it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you ever heard of this cooking process, and do you have any ideas about how it's really done?
Well, I have to tell you, I haven't heard of it done quite this way. I've heard of packing something into salt.
No.
You know, yeah, you know, like a kosher salt or a rock salt, and putting it in a very hot oven, you know, whether it's a chicken or a hunk of steak or whatever. But I've not heard of cooking it this way, and I think the key has to be that you got to keep that salt in the pan over a heat source. And this may be an investment, but have you thought about a hot plate?
That's an idea.
You know, you have your pan with that hot salt, and it's sitting over a burner that you have sort of plugged in, or it's, you know, you can use, there are also ones that use containers of compressed gas, and they get pretty hot.
Right.
And then you can do it right at the table.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be a great way to do it.
It's sort of like a fondue experience.
I think it's a great idea.
So flavorful.
Hey, never underestimate the power of how good salt makes things taste.
Yeah.
And to cook it on the hot salt, what fun.
Yeah.
Hey, Pauline, you take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hey, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. What is the healthiest way to cook broccoli? That is the best way to cook it so all of those antioxidants are preserved. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by SuperTarget, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes, from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to get back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, here's the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the healthiest way to cook broccoli to keep all its antioxidants intact? Well, the answer is steam it. Dr. Andrew Weil compiled information from several studies on cooking broccoli. Now, it's on his website, but here's a synopsis. If you blanch it, you lose about 30% of its antioxidants. Pressure cooking leaches out 47%. Boiling water takes away 67% of the nutrients. But the all-time winner for wiping out broccoli's antioxidants is the microwave. Microwave those green stalks and you lose a whopping 97% of the antioxidants. Now, that's from a study by scientists working for the Spanish government. But I wonder why they didn't check out stir-frying. I'm sorry, it's not a complete study. Now, let's get back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up next. We have Jim on the line from Frostburg, Maryland. Hey, Jim, is it frosty in Frostburg?
Fortunately, not yet. We haven't had winter descend upon us yet, but we're anticipating it any day now. I'm calling you, Lynn, with a question about cookware. I've been the lucky beneficiary of an heirloom piece of copper cookery that I want to pass on to my children to use in, but I've noticed that the tin lining on the inside has been scratched and eroded over time.
Uh-huh.
And I need to understand how important that is to being able to continue to use the copper cookware.
What kind of pot is it? What kind of cookware is it?
It's a small stock pot, about probably a 4-quart. It's a, uh-huh, a Williams Sonoma piece from probably the early 70s, maybe late 60s. And it's seen some hard use, but uh-huh, it's still in wonderful shape, generally.
Oh, you know, though, literally, I have copper sitting in my kitchen, and I have some pots I cook with that could have belonged to my great-grandfather, mm-hmm, or my great-grandmother. Yeah, you're right about passing it on. It's going to go on forever. So your concern is the tin has worn away a bit, and you're wondering, do you have to retin it? Is there any danger?
That was my question. Is there any risk of tainting food by cooking it on?
Yeah, well, unfortunately there is, because there can be some pretty tricky reactions between copper, bare copper, and a lot of different foods. If there's a nicking or whatever near the very top of the pan where it won't come in much contact, then a lot of people kind of let it go. But, mm-hmm, but usually that's not where wear happens. It happens in the whole bottom and the belly of a pan. So I think you do need to have it retinned. And lamentably, unlike France, where people who were used to be called tin knockers, isn't that a wonderful term. Tin knockers used to literally go from town to town, you know, like peddlers, and they would come in and they would just re-tin your pans right there.
Were those the same as whitesmiths, I believe they were called, too?
Gee, I've not heard that term, but it would make sense, wouldn't it?
I'd heard years ago the term whitesmiths and blacksmiths.
Yeah, maybe it was that they were the tin workers. But this is the thing. You can send the pan away and have it re-tinned.
Okay.
And we've got, I don't remember the exact names, but we have two sources that are on the Splendid Table website. And the information is there, and you can contact these organizations. Usually what happens is you have to pay for the shipping both ways, and then they charge you some by the inch. So, but I'd say contact the two and ask how they charge. And ask how long it takes, et cetera, so that, you know, you don't end up with a spending money that you don't have to spend. But it's going to probably run you somewhere between $30 and $50 in that neighborhood.
That's all right. It's a beautiful piece.
Well, yeah.
A companion piece to go with it.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
My children will be the fourth generation that'll be working with this.
Oh, this is wonderful. And also, you would pay four or five times that, or at least three times that for that pot today.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's worth it. And just ask everybody to use wooden implements inside the pan, because that'll save a lot of the interior.
Okay.
Yeah. This is where the wooden spatula comes in.
Sure. Thanks for your help.
Hey, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Isn't that a lovely idea to take a pan? You know, it doesn't even have to be a copper pot. It can be a favorite cast iron skillet or just the pot you like a lot. And figure you're going to leave it to someone you know is going to really enjoy it. I have in my will where my pots go, where my knives go. Yeah, I know. Well, I don't do jewels and I don't do furs. Anyway, call us 800-537-5252. We've got Thomas on the line from Santa Monica, California. Hey, Thomas, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I had a couple of questions that are sort of related that I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
I got invited to a potluck dinner tonight with a very interesting man named Alain Robbe-Grillet, who was a major French novelist. He kind of reinvented the French novel. In the 50s and the 60s, and then he was involved in a number of the French New Wave movies, particularly a movie called Last Year at Marienbad.
I remember that. It was, yeah. In fact, I saw it twice to figure it out. Yes.
Uh-huh, exactly. But he's 82.
Oh, my.
And he's here at UCLA this week. And I got invited to a potluck dinner with him tonight.
So how lucky.
To figure out, I know, it's like you can't say no to that.
So are you calling saying, what should I make?
That was sort of occurred to me this morning. But I think I'm going to make, I don't have that much time this afternoon, and I think I'm going to make a roast New York strip steak from Barbara Kafka's roasting book.
Oh, that would be a great idea.
It's kind of like a roast beef. It's kind of easy, doesn't take that much time.
And also it's something that he would enjoy. That's America.
Uh-huh,
you know, that's
uh-huh,
America, uh-huh. Exactly.
And I'll bring a good California red wine.
Yes. But did you have another question?
But along those lines, I wanted to ask you, what were some of your favorite cookbooks? And sort of almost more importantly, what are some of your favorite sources for bibliography? You know, like, for example, I kind of collect, I love to cook fish a lot.
Right.
And I have a number of books on fish, but there are so many out there that I was wondering if there was a source to help pick which ones would be the most interesting.
You know, several people are working in the country. They're historians that are working on bibliographies, you know, of the history of books about food. But bibliographies that are specifically geared toward technique and that sort of thing, you know where I would go? I would go to the websites of places like the Culinary Institute of America, Johnston Wales, which is another, you know, another essentially restaurant school, because the books that people train with when you're looking at techniques and information is what you want.
Uh-huh.
And when you talk about, I mean, when you ask me my favorite books, I have to say the two books that come to mind for me are reference books. One, and they're both on science. One is Cookwise by Shirley Currier, dynamite food scientist and cook. This one has recipes. And the other one is called On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee. And those, armed with those two, you can kind of figure out most everything. But I guess I'm into reference books because I have so many books about recipes and every magazine has recipes, but it's the how to and the why and the what that kind of puts me in control.
This is a great answer. It's like I have a ton of books and I don't know either of those. I remember one called The Making of the Cook.
Now that's a written book in the sense it's about training at one of the restaurant schools. Wonderful book to read. Absolutely wonderful. And there's a lot of books like that. But as far as the how to, the why and the what, another one for great reference for vegetables, Elizabeth Schneider. And I think it's something like vegetables, amaranth to zucchini. If you ever see Elizabeth Schneider's name on anything to do with produce, you are looking at one of the great scholars, and her bibliography will be dynamite.
Great.
Dynamite. Same is true for Harold McGee as well on science. I'm just trying to think. I mean, Steve Reichlin on barbecue, because I love the taste of his food.
Uh-huh.
And I guess the other thing is, there are two Southern Indian cooks who essentially cook basically mostly without meat. And one is Raghavan Iyer, who did Turmeric Trail, I think it is, and Maya Kaimal, or Kaimal, I'm never pronounced it correctly, with a K. And she did something about the Kerala with a K. It's the southwest coast of India. Fabulous book. And information, a tremendous amount of information in both of them.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's just a sort of scattershot, but that's what, when I pictured my bookshelves, that's what came into my head.
Oh, you see, that's just great to know, because I bet I could take any of those to bed.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The pile next to the bed is always the significant one.
Yeah, and I don't know any of those books.
Take a shot. You know what? Go to the library and take a look, and then and see if you like them, and then you decide whether or not you want to buy them.
Well, thank you for a great and completely unexpected answer.
You're welcome.
Steve Reichlin's barbecue Bible on the shelf.
Well, this is a good one. And by the way, have a great time tonight.
Oh, well, thanks very much.
What a rare experience. Hey, you take care.
Well, thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome. Okay. Bye, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. I am just back from New York City, and I had a dynamite meal. And it's Indian food. Now, for everybody who's a fan of Indian food, all right, I think you know that a lot of restaurants can get really sloppy. Well, this is a place called Amma, A-M-M-A. It means mom or mother. It's in the East 50s in New York City. It's all up on the website under Lynn's Finds. And this is what I think of as contemporary Indian food. There are two men in this restaurant who are reinterpreting these traditional dishes from all over India. One is called Suvir Saran, and then Chef Hemant Mathur. I had a dish that was a pile of shards of crisp fried okra that tasted as though they had been rolled in fresh coconut and chili. It was fabulous. And then there were these little sort of puffy rice cakes that have been steamed. They're called idli, and they're from southern India. But the chef had rolled them in toasted mustard seeds and then sauteed them with fresh curry leaves. Ah! And it's not inexpensive. Figure 30 to 50 bucks a person. It's called Amma. It's a whole new take on Indian food, and it's fabulous. That's my find. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Greg is calling. Greg, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Some friends and I decided that we had lived in Kentucky all of our lives, but we had never partaken in Kentucky tradition of the mint julep on Derby Day.
Ah.
So we went out to the store, we got a nice bottle of Kentucky bourbon, and we got some mint julep syrup, and we sat back to watch the Derby and took a sip of our mint julep and decided it was probably the most disgusting thing we ever drank in our lives. And so now I'm stuck with all these bottles of, I got two bottles of mint julep syrup, and barely any of them have been used. So I was hoping that maybe you would have a suggestion for something I might could do with this syrup rather than just pitch it.
What does the syrup taste like? I mean, it sounds like the syrup is the problem, not the bourbon.
Most likely. It is basically just a green sort of tasting, or green kind of thick mint syrup.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, here's the thing. Just in the defense of the mint julep. Now, I wasn't born and raised in Kentucky, but I'm a fan. And just if you were to try making it just with your own homemade sugar syrup, which
right.
is really easy. It's equal sugar and water. Put it in a saucepan. Let it simmer until it's clear. Cool it, and you've got it. It'll keep in the fridge forever. But just do that with fresh mint and bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
It's killer.
But, really?
Yeah, it really is good. I have a feeling that mint syrup is something that's awful and doctored, and sell it at a garage sale.
There you go. Maybe take it back to the store and say, whatever it was you recommended to me was trash.
I think, get your money back and go out and buy some fresh mint and sugar.
Sounds good.
Hey, I wish I could have helped you with something terribly creative, but I think you don't deserve bad food.
Well, thank you.
All okay, right. Greg, take care.
You too. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us at 800-537-5252. Hey, have you seen the latest addition to the exotic bag salad clan? It's called Mache, that's spelled M-A-C-H-E, and it's not cheap. Now, it's a traditional salad green in Europe. I've been waiting for someone to grow it here, and it's finally happened. The outfit is called Epic Roots. Now, we have CEO Todd Koons on the line. Hey, Todd, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for calling.
Well, Todd, can you explain what Mache is?
I certainly can. It's really an heirloom green. It's one of the oldest cultivated greens in existence. It comes from Europe, and it has a unique and marvelous flavor, a wonderful texture, and it grows in a tiny little bouquet of like six leaves.
They're like heart-shaped almost. They're these little dark green leaves that are kind of heart-shaped, right?
Well, each leaf has that distinct sort of look to it, and it has a wonderful nutty sort of buttery flavor.
And it's used as a salad green.
It is.
Okay, so why is it so expensive? Not to put you on the spot, of course.
Well, it's expensive right now because there's a small amount of it grown, and it's one of those greens that actually takes a lot of time and attention. It has a lot of time in the ground, and it grows very low to the ground, so you're always hand harvesting that. As we grow more and more volume, of course, the price comes down.
Uh-huh. So tell me, I mean, do you just dress it with salad dressing? I mean, oil and vinegar kind of thing?
Well, I like to simply dress it, to really keep it as light as possible. It doesn't want a lot of dressing on it.
Right.
So just even traditionally, like a little squeeze of lemon and some salt and a little olive oil or something like that. But it marries well with nut oils and also citrus vinaigrettes and things of that nature.
Okay. Well, how's it selling?
Oh, actually, it's doing quite well. But it's a big job anytime you introduce a something that the American public is not familiar with. You actually have to go get them, you know, singularly to open their mouth and go, here, taste this. And then it's amazing what happens. There's a real evolution that happens from that point. It was very much like spring mix a decade ago.
Oh, yeah, and that's now everywhere.
Well, and the Europeans consume over 50 million pounds of mosh a year. It's really a real mainstay of their salad world. And I assume since it's not bitter like some of the chicory family, that Americans will grow to love this too.
Todd, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Todd Koons is CEO of Epic Roots, growers of mosh salad greens. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this from our silly joke list. What vegetable did Noah leave off the ark? Well, it was the leek, of course. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Now, be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. I just can't leave you guys alone, you know? I mean, look, I have ideas about what you should be eating, you know, midweek, the easy stuff. So register for the newsletter online. I mean, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift, with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The California Wine Piece was produced by John Marston. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Thanks for joining us. See you next week, guys. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.